What was the NBA like in the 70s? How did dribbling improve so dramatically back then? Was 1976 truly the golden age of the NBA? The only question left is, say it with me, you win. Hey, sports fans, Coach Nick here, and welcome to the B-Ball Breakdown Podcast. Today, I'm excited to bring on author Adam Cribley, who has just written a great book called Tall Tales and Short Shorts, Dr. J, Pistol Pete, and the Birth of the Modern NBA. And he's also a professor at Southeast Missouri State. Adam Cribley, thank you for joining us today and to talk about your book and about the history of the NBA.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Not a problem. And, you know, I thought we can kind of jump right into it because your focus is pretty much the 70s in the NBA starting there. And I think that there's a really interesting development that happens right around 1970. And I'm wondering if you can give me some more insight because it's kind of a fascinating thing where, you know, if you watch, you know, the Eastern Conference Finals, I believe it's like 67 between the Celtics and the Philadelphia Warriors. You see guards that dribble with the right hand going to their left. You don't see a lot of dribbling ability at all, really. Nobody through the legs much or behind the back. And then all of a sudden, 1970-71 rolls around, and you got guys doing spin moves, behind the back, crossovers in a very short time. And I'm wondering if you can help me get some insight into like what happened there and why dribbling exploded at the NBA level.
Well, I think the one thing that's been looked at by some historians is the influence of the playground game. And so the playground game really picks up kind of mid to late 60s, and you have not only places like Rucker Park in New York City, but also in Philly, the Baker League and that sort of thing, that Dr. J, Pistol Pete, they're kind of coming of age. But maybe even more than that, Pistol Pete's a great example of that newfound wizardry on the court. And another one, though, is Earl Monroe. And Earl the Pearl had a mean spin move, could go either way. He could get in the lane and score. And so I think you have a generation of guys growing up on that street ball game where, I mean, if you're dribbling to your left with your right hand, you're going to get it picked every time if you're playing on the playgrounds. And so some bad habits maybe that even great players like Jerry West, you watch Jerry West trying to go left and he might as well have tied his left hand behind his back dribbling the ball. But that his generation is kind of going out, and that playground style is definitely coming into the game in the early 70s.
You know, in Jerry's defense, he actually showed this to me once. I was actually on the court with him, and he was describing some of the moves he used to use. And one of them was he would dribble the ball in his right hand and, like, have it – he would kind of gallop at his man with the right hand forward and the right foot forward and kind of daring the man to reach in. And if he did, he would do, like, an inside out and keep it in the right hand and then go right by him. So – I will give him a little credit where, even though obviously he really looked uncomfortable kind of going to his left hand, even though every once in a while he would, he did at least have – there was some reason as to why you didn't just reach in and steal it. Like that's sort of like why I scratch my head a lot when I'm watching that, saying the guy could just knock it away every time. But at least for Jerry West, you know, perspective, he did have a move that would counter that to some degree. But I think you're right, because what's interesting for me as a coach is that, you know, at some point – I have to imagine the playground stuff was happening probably even in the 50s, right? We probably had spin moves and crossovers. That's fair enough to say, right?
Right, and I think, I mean, Bob Cousy clearly is doing it in the NBA, so it's not as if these are the first players to do it in the late 60s and 70s, but yeah, the playground game goes to a different level, I think, mid-60s, late 60s.
Because I think the interesting parallel could very well be, you know, when the jump shot first came in, you know, Hank Lucetti or Kenny Sailors or whoever in like the 40s, you had coaches across the country saying, no player will ever shoot that way for me. And I have to imagine there's a similar parallel that way to like the dribbling stuff where these coaches probably that was why it didn't take hold until the 70s, which is why, you know, these coaches from the youth leagues on were probably even just saying, nope, you're not going to do that fancy crossover behind the back stuff on my team. And the players as a result never really developed that until that explosion. Is that, would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that there's something to it too, that if a player throws a behind the back pass and it goes into the stands, that looks a lot worse than a player throwing a chest pass that goes into the stand. So I think there's that element of, well, you know, if he's doing something fancy and it goes wrong, that it's so much more worse, I think, from a coaching perspective than it is maybe for the simple play that doesn't work out.
For sure, for sure. And getting back to like, the sort of the NBA and the dribbling stuff specifically, it's funny because when you finally see it, you realize that it is actually fundamentally sound. It is a better way to get around a player, right? To actually go to your other hand sometimes is advantageous. So you mentioned Pistol Pete, and then he's usually the guy I think that people mention right away. But right, there are other guys that suddenly took this into another direction. And I think what happens is like Billy Cunningham is a good example, right? He was an all-star, right, in the late 60s.
Sure.
And he was a guy that, his skill was pretty low compared to like Clyde Frazier. So it's interesting, right? I think what we ended up seeing is in a very short order, players who could have been really great in like 1968 by 71 wouldn't even be in the league, I think, right?
Sure. No, and there's a huge influx of talent, I think, that that comes into the league. And you're right. Some players that had been all-stars, superstars in the late 60s. A great example for me is Jerry Lucas. Lucas was a fantastic player, a multi-time all-star, considered one of the greatest players in the league by many people in the 60s. And by the 70s, he's just, he's a step slow. He's not able to use the intellectual tools and those sorts of things because he's getting jumped over. And so I think that there's certainly a generational change between the late 60s and early 70s that all kind of culminates at the same time.
Sure. And I think there's also, it's not code, but I think what you're also saying is that after Earl Lloyd, and they broke the racial barrier in the NBA in 19, remember when that was? What year that was? 1950 something.
Yeah, early 50s. Yeah.
So basically, and that progression was still very slow for a long time, right? And so eventually, though, by around 1970, I mean, it was still the percentage of African-American players is still low, but at least it was kind of getting higher and higher in a way that influence clearly would see some of these players who weren't great athletes. And by the way, not necessarily that skilled either, right, to some degree. Just being phased out. It's a natural order of selection, I suppose.
Yeah, no, completely. And it's really in... I don't have the exact year, but it's right around 1970 when the league becomes majority African-American. So it's about 50-50 in 1970, and by 1979, it's 75-25. So
right.
The influx of talented African-American players certainly jumps. And again, it's not coded at all to say that many of the African-American players that are coming in had played that playground style, because inner cities in the late 60s are predominantly populated by African-Americans. So the players playing on the playgrounds are African-Americans. They bring that aesthetic to the game, and so naturally the game's going to change when you have the more talented players coming in practicing that style.
Sure, and we can kind of take a deep dive into sort of what we're saying, because I mean, I think if you try and use that, it's sort of a racist term now if you want to use that like street ball phrase on
sure.
people, like in organized basketball. Whereas in my mind, when you watch some of the stuff like Dr. J at Rucker Park or earlier in the early 70s, it actually feels like there was more structure on the playgrounds anyway, like sort of built in. It wasn't completely just one-on-one isolation, like almost like we see now if you go to the park now. I feel like there was a little sense of movement and, team stuff even back then on the playgrounds.
Sure, and a lot of it's 3-on-3, 5-on-5, some combination of that. 3-on-3 was really popular at the time. And so, yes, if one person's going to 1-on-1, his teammates aren't going to get him the ball the next time. And so there's a lot of it's not, you're right, it's not that playground 1-on-1, try to embarrass the guy in front of you every single time down the court. Now, some of that did get into the game, but a lot of it was there was ball movement. There are people working to get open and throwing the ball into the post and kind of cutting off of that. And so, yeah, it's not that stereotypical street ball, no one's playing defense. I mean, it's very much a challenge to their masculinity if somebody scores on them. So they're trying not to let people score. They're working with teammates. It's not the style that we see and maybe demean today.
Yeah, it's worthy of like some sort of documentary. I don't know how much visual evidence exists right now from the playground style of the 50s and the 60s, because I would like to take a deep dive into that and do that, because I feel like, when I was growing up, for instance, in the, 80s, early 80s, like, there were just certain rules. Like, if the ball went to the high post, you cut to the basket from the wing.
Sure.
No one ever taught you that. It just sort of, that's what you did. And I don't even think we have those rules anymore. That's not how young kids play anymore for whatever whatever reason. But it seemed like even more so back then. And perhaps it's just because, you know, in the 50s, you were only, you know, 50 years removed from the invention of the game, basically, in a way that, like, those the style had sort of, you know, was still taking hold and was still really strong over, like, you know, those kind of immutable fundamentals, I suppose, of movement.
Well, I think there's a time, it's a time of development. You mentioned earlier the jump shot. I mean, the jump shot at that point is only 15 years old. So to move from a set shot to people going between the legs and behind the back, and that's, I mean, that it's a transformation. It's a process. It's not something that happens overnight. And so a lot of those fundamentals are still very much in place. The, you know, I always make the joke of the Hoosiers movie. You have to pass the ball four times before you shoot it. And that, while tongue in cheek, is kind of still what's going on the playground. They're still moving the ball around. They're still looking for teammates and cutters, and they're doing a lot more of that than, again, we think of today.
What's interesting is that when I think of the early 70s, I think of those old straight razors that gave people such great shaves. And you can get that same close, smooth shave from Harry's Razors today. Harry's is all about a great shave at a fair price, founded by two guys named Jeff and Andy, who did something crazy. They bought a German razor factory and now make the highest quality blades for half the price of the leading five-blade razor. And you don't have to bother the clerk to open up the cabinet to prevent black market razor theft. They send them right to your door. They've also got great shaving cream, awesome-smelling post-shave balm, and shaving sets that come with everything. Visit harrys.com/coachnick, and you'll get their trial set absolutely free. Just pay for some shipping. You'll get an ergonomic razor handle, five precision-engineered blades with lubricating strip, rich lathering gel, and a travel blade cover. Just head to harrys.com/coachnick now and get that smooth shave you've been waiting for. You know, the thing that was startling to me, as I'm reading your book and I'm going through, I'm just like calling up random YouTube videos to see real play as well, like the ABA, NBA All-Star, you know, game in 72. They have on the full game, and then you can watch like the Bucks and the Knicks from 71. The thing that startles me the most about even particularly that the Bucks-Knicks, which is, I'm sure, extremely normal or common in that era, was just how fast the game was. And I just did, interestingly enough, a little man video breakdown. I don't know if you saw where I compared Tony Archibald's best year to Allen Iverson and to Isaiah Thomas. But when you compare the pace, it's insane how much faster they played back then. Are you startled by that when you started digging through the research and watching some of this footage?
I am, and I'd say that it was especially startling because when I started doing the research, I grew up a fan of, you know, basketball in the 1990s. And so I was a Pacers, Knicks, Heat, like those rivalries to me were what I knew basketball to be at that age. And now watching, and I can't watch that. It's, you know, the game's 82 to 86 with 30 seconds left, and it's fouling and physical. The game in the early late 60s, early 70s is fast paced, and the number of possessions that they get is insane. And you look at things now like efficiency and the number of turnovers, they're throwing the ball all over the place and getting up and down. It's exciting to watch, but it's definitely jarring if you're not used to that style, if you're used to the modern game, or like me, grew up on the 90s, that it almost looks like a different sport, how fast the game is in the early 70s.
Right. And it's exciting only because, yeah, we've kind of come back to that. If I'm not mistaken, the pace of the Warriors last year, which I think was number one or, you know, top five at least, was like 99. And sure, the pace of the when Tiny led the league in scoring and in assists that year for the Royals, right?
Yeah, the Royals. Yeah.
Was like 117. You know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
yeah, sure. Yep.
20% more possessions, and that's just, they were not number one that year, as far as I remember. So, it's up and down in a way that, like, it's frenetic, and the skill level still wasn't high enough, I think, in the 70s, in a way that, while you might have seen turnovers and some weird ball handling and whatever because they just, you know, the level hadn't improved like it is now, the excitement, I think, is rooted in the fact that you just never really knew what was going to happen from one play to the next. Whereas I think in comparison in the 90s, Right, you're like, okay, Ewing's gonna go down. He's gonna get the shot, right? And you know they're
Sure.
gonna Keem's gonna get the ball. He's gonna kick it out. They're gonna shoot a three. Like you kind of got the sense that like you knew what was going to happen. It was kind of predictable to some degree. Where like when I watch hockey now, I'm not a hockey fan, know anything about it, but it seems like the ice makes it just difficult enough where even the best players, they're still the ball. The puck's still gonna get loose a little bit, and they're gonna slip a little bit. And you never quite know exactly how it's gonna go. And I think it's that jazz that Phil Jackson even talks about in his books. That's what was so captivating, and I think it's what's we've finally come full circle, and hopefully, I think we're recapturing more fans for the NBA now.
Absolutely. And I think if you watch the one big difference in the 70s is that there was still a huge reliance on the traditional center that you threw the ball into in the low post. The difference from that in the Ewing era is you didn't throw the ball in the low post and then four guys stand on the other side of the court and watch him. You throw the ball in the low post, people are cutting, people are shifting, they're trying to get some action where they get an open 12 to 15 footer, or the center's making a move. And so you have one of my favorite teams to watch from the early 70s is the Bulls. So they had a big center named Tom Bullerwinkle. They throw it in. He's 7 foot, 280 pounds, and he just acted as a pivot. People would cut off him. He'd throw the ball over his head or behind his back. Fantastic passer from the post, but it's not that traditional. You throw it into the big man, and everybody stands and watches him play. So it's much more like today, but there's also that pace, but there's also an emphasis on getting the ball inside. It's not trying to move the ball around for an open three in a corner. So it's definitely a different type of style.
For sure. And I grew up in Chicago, and we had heard about those mythical Bulls teams. There was no way to see those games,
Sure.
growing up. We just heard about Norm Van Leer and Jerry Sloan and Boerwinkel, who, was then he later did the radio commentary, so we knew him from that. But if you watch it now, it's like while it is low post, it's also a lot of high post. A lot of elbow action, which is what we see today more than ever, which really makes me excited because it tells you that that was right. Like they understood when Dutch Dennert in the 20s and the original Celtics was doing high post action, like they understood then how the game kind of worked and should be played. And I agree. So I think that it's an unmistakable influence from someone like John Wooden, who ran the UCLA high post offense for the most part, except for when Lew Alcindor was there. They went a little bit more low, but still, he still played high. And I feel like what you see there is a lot of sort of that system basketball, which is free form and not called plays, but the spacing and alignment was pretty, I don't want to say strict, but certainly pretty. I guess what's the word? Regimented to some degree. Like all five players knew where they were all kind of going on a hand, right?
Sure, and you see a lot of spacing there. So you see, for example, if you throw the ball into Bullerwinkle at the high post, guards are cutting off him, but on the weak side, you've got Bob Love or Chet Walker kind of spacing the floor. And if his defender sloughs in, then you've got a 15-footer on the opposite wing. And so there's it without a three-point line, they're not spacing to 23 feet. They're spacing to 16 or 18. But it's still that very similar type of their spacing. Dare I use the term, pace and space. There's a little bit of that already going on kind of in the 70s, especially with some teams. One thing I really like, though, is that not every team played that way. So if you watch the NBA in the early 70s to the throughout the 70s, you have so many different styles of play that there's not that follow the leader. Everybody has to play the same style as the modern day, Golden State Warriors because of their success. Every team's going to try to replicate that. Every team kind of had a unique style. And I think it made the game a lot more, distinct, in that you'd watch a Kings Bulls game looks a lot different than a Lakers Knicks game then. And I think that's something that I really enjoyed watching from that decade.
Yeah, the only thing I think also connects with that is the region, like where you were from. And I think it's probably more like on the high school, maybe college level, it was a little bit more like that. But depending on what part of the country you were in, sort of dictated how you played the game. I mean, this is going back a little bit earlier than the 70s, but I kind of feel like there was a connection there where, like Indiana was just fast break basketball and New York was sort of give and go and right and, it's sneaky kind of stuff. And, interestingly enough, it's until Wooden got here, as far as I can tell, my research was, California was a sort of a slow paced. They didn't dribble a lot. They kind of didn't want to pass the ball up quickly up the court. And I feel like that there's some connection to that too, or certainly at least where the players were growing up regionally influenced them all the way up through the NBA.
Absolutely. And I think something else that I always enjoy watching is, so they didn't have the textbook shooting strokes, and so you've got some really unique kind of releases, and so the whole game, you're right, there are definitely regional variations in the game that I think certainly are from earlier times, but even through the 70s, Indiana fans wanted that fast-paced up and down basketball. And I think that's maybe best explained by looking at the Lakers. We think about the Showtime Lakers of the 80s, that fast break style. Well, that originated really in the early 70s with the 72 Lakers, that Wilt Chamberlain got a rebound and would outlet it to almost half court, and then they're fast breaking. And so definitely these styles, I think, certainly began earlier, but definitely continue through the 70s.
For sure, for sure. And the shooting is a great point, too, because, you know, we've been slowly refining the fundamentals of how to teach shooting. And I feel like if you were playing in 1971 in the NBA, you grew up, I'd say you were probably, 10 in 1961. And that means you were being taught the same fundamentals that were being taught in 1941, probably. There hasn't been a lot of difference there. And that was still when two-handed set shots were being shot. So it's a really kind of a fascinating evolution of how that was all taught and then how it ultimately, you know, got it to the game. And then I feel like every year that I go by, you know, I think more of these players move to more of a natural, like, okay, they're showing me 10 toes to the rim, they're showing me this stuff, but that's not really how they did it. And you kind of get at every level of, you know, from high school to college to the pros, you kind of see them get farther away from like these strict notions of how you're supposed to do it. And as well, then you get some really interesting things as far as shooting goes. So, you know what, I find the most interesting thing about what happens with, you know, in the mid-70s and as we progress, was it sort of feels like the golden age of the NBA, maybe even more so than even now, was after the ABA merger, and you started to throw another, you know, 20 of the best players in the world into the NBA. What I would notice from those years, from 76 to 80, was not only did you have the best athletes, the best skilled players playing all on the same court, but they were playing, you know, triangle offense. You'd see Princeton, you would see UCLA high post, these sort of regimented, really great five-man system basketball, and it combined with great athleticism and skill. Like, to me, that's some of the best basketball I've still seen to this day.
Sure, and I think that you those stars all come in, and they are playing systems. They are playing that type of game. And really, the only time that they have that isolation clear out is, hey, we need Dr. J to get a bucket because it's a tie game with 11 seconds left. And they're not relying on that every time down the court. And so they're running all these different offenses, these, as you said, these very kind of regimented offenses. But you have some incredibly creative players running them. And so they still have the high flying, the exciting play. I talk about this in the book, but I'll say till my grave that the 76-77 season was the most exciting season in basketball history, because you have two really good teams, and the Pacers and the Spurs coming in, or no, the Pacers and the Nets, neither team was great. But you have all this superstar talent coming in all at once that is unprecedented, and it revolutionized the game. And so I think that people that point to Magic and Larry Bird coming in 1980 as being the pivot, I think that it's 76, it's when the merger happens, that we really see this. Like you said, it's a short-lived golden age, but it's some high-quality basketball for the most part in that 4 or 5 year stretch.
For sure. And the interesting thing is, as you got a little bit farther into the 70s, until the end of the 70s, what you then would see would be, you know, nice regimented five-man system basketball. But as they got a little bit tired and as the quarter progressed, it would kind of get devolved into some more one-on-one, and the game would get kind of messy, and the coach would call timeout and say, okay, guys, remember, we run, you know, let's run our, get our two-guard front, whatever. And then they would do it again, and they get a little tired. So it's interesting. We kind of started to see this slow dissolution of that, and then into the 80s. But what's interesting to me is that what you notice is in the 70s, you see a lot of two-guard front offenses, like almost exclusively. And then it's something happens, and I'm wondering what your take on it is, that all of a sudden, around, you know, 79, and I think that I'm leading you on this question, but certainly something happens where all of a sudden it goes to a one-guard front, and most teams want that one lead guard out there. And I'm wondering if you've noticed that or have any sense of an evolution of how that transformed.
No, you're right. And I think you're right in tracing it to the late to 78, 79. I think in part it's because the league's getting bigger. And so you're bringing in wing players now that are 6'5", 6'6", 6'7", in some cases. George Gervin's playing small or playing shooting guard, and he's 6'8". Well, I mean, he's a good ball handler, but he's a scorer. He's a slasher. He's not the prototypical point guard. If you look at like the 72 Lakers, for example, that have Gale Goodrich and Jerry West, they have two guys that can handle the ball really well. And that and their teams, the 75 Warriors are a great example, a really super deep team that has a number of guys that can handle the ball, but are 6 foot, 6'2", 6'4". I think there was that fascination, that love of the big guard that I think is part of it at least. So you're getting away from the two playmakers and you're going to one playmaker with two slashers or shooters on the wings. And I think that's part of it. I didn't find anything definitive that a reason for that transition, but it just feels like Billy Knight of the Pacers, another example of a 6'5", 6'6" guy that could get buckets, but he's not a great ball handler. You don't want him to come and initiate the offense. I think that could be part of it.
Sure. I mean, that all makes perfect sense, too. I kind of feel like part of it was Magic and Isaiah.
Oh, sure, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And all of a sudden, and that trickled down very quickly to, you know, even the high school level. I remember, you know, if I would have had a two-guard front, I had to play point guard, but I wasn't a great ball handler. I was much more of a shooting guard. I would have been a lot easier for me because when there's a guard next to me, I could relieve the pressure. But instead, they were like, here's the ball, here's the 50 feet, good luck, you know, and go up. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with Magic and those guys who came in all of a sudden. They wanted that dynamic one guard leading the break and then initiating the offense. The funny thing is when I had talked to Pete Newell about this, and you know, when you have a two-guard front and two forwards and one center, you kind of have a more open floor. Whereas mm-hmm. when you have one guard on top and two forwards, you got to have two guys like down by the baseline or in the corner or something. Their men can get in the way down by the basket a little bit easier. So I always found that an interesting argument that a two-guard front actually spaces the floor better.
Well, and we mentioned that Bulls team earlier. That always sticks with me that Dick Motta had his alignment was he wanted two guards to be able to guard the basket if the other team came on a fast break. Yeah. His forwards were going forward to try to score the basketball, and the center is in the middle as a pivot. And I'm like, wow, it's as if the names of the positions kind of fit there. But you don't see that later, and you're right. By the late 70s, it's the point guards getting back and the point guards initiating the offense, and everybody else is kind of in scoring position.
You know, you just blew my mind because you're right. In theory, if you want to think about getting back on defense, that's why you call those guys guards and why you call the other guys forwards. You know what? I'm not even really sure I appreciated that until just now.
Right. And I didn't until I read Motta. It was one of Motta's books or he had a quote in an article or something. But yeah, and that I had the same kind of moment of like, oh, wow, guards and forwards. That makes great sense.
Did you talk to Thad Motta? Or not Thad Motta, excuse me, guy. Did you talk to Dick Motta at all for this book?
I'm an Ohio State fan, so Thad Motta still kind of hurts.
All right, fair enough. So, I don't think there's a relation, by the way, is there? No, he spells it differently, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
But no, I intentionally didn't talk to any players or coaches for this book because some of my other work is done with things like historical memory and how people remember the past. And I really didn't want the book to be colored with those rose-colored glasses of, hey, 40 years ago, this is what I remember. And in working on a project since then, I've talked to players and had great conversations, but it's still, there's always that element of they remember things maybe differently than actually happened. And fun story about that. So I wanted to get blurbs for the back of the book. And so I managed to get a hold of Dave Cowens, had a great conversation with Dave Cowens. And he said, yeah, send me a copy of the book. And again, had a fantastic conversation. Great guy to talk to on the phone. But he looked at the book and said, you know, I don't think I want to write a blurb because I see some inaccuracies. You know, I never said this. And so I went back to my sources and, you know, the New York Times said he said that, but 40 years and later, and maybe he remembered it a little differently, or maybe he didn't say that and it was misreported. But I decided that I was glad I didn't have a book full of those sorts of contradictions I had to iron out. So
sure.
I did talk to Dick Motta, but I read a lot of his stuff and super smart guy.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because do you know what he does now?
Who's that, Motta?
Yeah.
No, I don't.
He runs a bed and breakfast with his wife, in a way that I kind of – I got to figure out. It's the Bluebird Inn. I'm just looking it up right now because I got to remember it's in Utah. Where is it? It's I forgot what state it's in, but it's a beautiful little bed and breakfast. And it's like, can you imagine, like, you show up to stay at this place, and all of a sudden it's a legendary Chicago Bulls coach who, you know, won a title with – wait, let's see. Dick Motta won with Washington?
Yeah. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, and later on. And so, anyway, I think that's hilarious. And so I'm going to have to try and you've inspired me to get him on the show and see if I can't get him to call in. I've had Frank Layden on once, and which is an
Sure.
amazing pod. And so,
Yep.
at any rate, but yeah, it is really fascinating because you're talking a lot about, sort of the influence we're talking about of coaches, probably was never at its greatest than like at the 70s, or maybe that was when it peaked and then it's, the influence has slowly gone down. I think you can argue maybe back, it's kind of back now to where it used to be. I was thinking though, can we let's spotlight a few of the more interesting quirky characters that you encountered while writing this book that maybe like caught your eye that you hadn't really heard about before.
Well, I think one from an on-court standpoint, like I mentioned earlier, was Tom Bullerwinkle, this kind of big pass, passing big man. You mentioned earlier as well, Tiny Archibald. I knew the points and assists, that he was the only person to have led the league in those and all that sort of thing. But just the way that he played was always amazing. That he was, and I like that your comparisons with Iverson and such, that he could get into the lane and score. As far as quirky off-court personalities, honestly, one of my favorite that I came across is Neil Walk. And so Neil Walk was drafted second behind Lew Alcindor, who'd become Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and the Suns basically lost a coin flip, and so they're stuck with Walk, and Alcindor goes to Milwaukee. Walk was hilarious, and he was such a character. Like, he ends up going to the Knicks later in his career. He bounced around a little bit, had a couple really good seasons where he's averaging, I don't have the numbers up, 18-8 or something like that, where he's putting up good numbers. And he became a vegetarian, lost 25 pounds, didn't have the strength to push around inside. But some of the things, he was a fantastic source for reporters who wanted a quote. If they wanted something unfiltered, players to drop the F-bomb, like, they would go to Neil Walk, and he was going to supply that every time. So he was one of the fun personalities that I knew him as the guy who got drafted after Kareem, but the more you dig into it, like, wow, there's really some interesting characters that kind of emerge out of that 70s, out of that era.
Absolutely. One guy that kind of, and by the way, that guy was as hairy as anybody could be. Like, I remember when you
Oh,
see
yeah.
that footage, it's like it's his back and his chest is crazy. I don't know, maybe players are waxing these days, but and it's always fun to watch those early 70s Suns teams because they ran the triangle offense with, Cotton Fitzsimmons
Sure.
was the coach who had been Tex Winter's assistant at K-State, and they ran it probably as well as any other team, probably maybe even better than the Bulls ever did even then. One guy that caught my eye as I'm reading your book was this guy Wendell Ladner, who to me played in the ABA, and obviously there's no book would be complete about the NBA in the 70s without having to talk about the ABA a little bit. But this guy sounded kind of like Jackie Moon.
Yeah, he was a playboy. I mean, he looked like Burt Reynolds, and so he would, he had this great 1970s mustache, and he was a teammate of Dr. J's in New York with the Nets, and unfortunately died in a plane crash shortly after they won the title in 74, 75, right in there somewhere. But he was a good player. He was very Jackie Moon. He was not as skilled in basketball as he was A, with the ladies, and B, with he was an enforcer. He'd come off the bench and beat some people up a little bit, and then after the game, he'd go to the nightclub and be out till 2, 3, 4 in the morning. He had girlfriends in every city, and just a fantastic character, total playboy, and but also really an on-court enforcer. So it was just a really interesting mix.
For sure, yeah. It just kind of struck me like there's something there about that, which I'm sure there was probably more of those kind of characters too. Now, let me ask you this: like, as you sprinkle in sort of cultural touchstones that were going on outside of basketball in the book, concurrently with what's going on the court, were there any kind of things that struck you as like really sort of interesting parallels as well that you didn't sort of think about beforehand or had any kind of influence on what was going on, in the NBA?
Sure. The best example of that to me is I went to Kent State University in Ohio for my master's degree. So I knew all about the Kent State shootings in May of 1970. Well, I didn't put that into basketball context until I was pretty deep in my research and found that was during the NBA Finals in 1970, the very famous Knicks Lakers. Willis Reed comes out and limps onto the court. That's Game 7's maybe played a week later, but they actually played the day after Kent State. And so that Knicks team's interesting in that two of the players, I believe it was Mike Riordan and Cassie Russell, had they were members of the National Guards. They missed some time because they were serving in the National Guard during the season. Well, at Madison Square Garden, before I think it's Game 5, maybe, where Willis Reed actually hurts himself, they play the national anthem, and there are people in the upper decks that aren't sitting for the national anthem. They're smoking pot in the third deck at Madison Square Garden.
Wow.
Just this very kind of politically and emotionally charged time in history. And the fact that the NBA is not immune to this is, and that Knicks team's been fantastically interesting, because not only do they have guys like Riordan and Russell playing for the national or participating in the National Guard, they've got Phil Jackson, who's very outspoken about his opposition to the war. They've got Bill Bradley, who ends up becoming Senator Bill Bradley, very outspoken in his opposition to the war. And so it's this really kind of unique mix. But I never put two and two together that May of 1970, they're playing this iconic finals at the same time at Vietnam and May 4th in Kent State.
Yeah, absolutely. And that I was definitely struck by that when I started to read it. I'm like, oh, you don't often think about the context of like what's going on, especially then. I feel like that we've heard about certain times in the 60s where we saw Lew Alcindor and Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali dealing with a lot of things that are going on politically, but not necessarily as much in the 70s. And so that was really interesting. One big thing for me that made me perk up is, nobody knew this until I started. I mean, no one ever mentioned this before. So I had, and I'm a big JFK conspiracy freak, and that kind of naturally gets to Watergate. I'm sure as a historian, you probably understand there are a lot of connections, either fringe or not, that connect JFK and Watergate. But when I was looking at some stuff, like you realize that the Watergate offices that they broke into in 1972 were that of Larry O'Brien. And I almost fell off my chair because I'm like, wait, that can't be the same Larry O'Brien as the Larry O'Brien trophy. And sure enough, it is. Did anything else come across when you were doing research about that like struck your that caught your eye?
Well, no, but that his experience with the Democratic National Party was a big reason why he got the post in 70, when did he come in? 74, maybe. But it's a big reason why he got that gig, was that experience. And in fact, he was seen as kind of the dark horse candidate when he came in. There was the deputy commissioner was a man named Simon Gourdin, who was an African American, highly qualified, had basically served as he was the deputy prior. So he was kind of seen as the heir apparent. Well, they went outside the organization because they wanted somebody, because of all the political things going on with the merger and the lawsuits going on. They wanted someone that had a stronger political background. So no, the fact that his offices were broken into, and that he played a leading role in that, was a big reason why O'Brien ends up getting the gig.
Okay, well, and that what that what that what that leads me to believe is that we need to talk to David Stern, because I think he would end up knowing what really happened with Watergate. Because there's too
Sure.
many questions
Yeah.
unanswered, and we know that Larry O'Brien's not around anymore. But certainly David Stern was his right-hand man for quite a long time before he took over in '85, I think. So
Right.
fascinating stuff when that pops up in my mind. One thing I didn't know reading the book was that Dr. J was actually drafted by the Bucks. We all had heard about the Hawks trying to sign him outright and play with Pistol Pete, which would have been amazing. By the way, did you come across any video footage of those games, the preseason games that they played together?
No, and I've seen some pictures. One of the amazing things to me was that one of the best firsthand account that we have of those games, other than some newspaper stuff, is actually David Thompson. So David Thompson, who ends up becoming a superstar for the Nuggets, went to those pre or at least to one of the preseason games, and later writes all about how it was this amazing connection. And so it's interesting, kind of the level there. But no, to the best of my knowledge, there's no video that exists of that. Just some pictures that we have that, and a lot of firsthand accounts that say it was just magic to watch those two play on the same team.
Yeah, that it's tantalizing. However, what would have been even more tantalizing would have been if the Bucks had gotten their way. I can't imagine what that would have been like with Oscar, Dr. J, and a young Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. That would have been a dynasty. I can't imagine them losing, very many games.
No, and with their skill sets, the way they complemented each other, there's not a lot of redundancy there. And so a point guard, a small forward, and a center, all three. Oscar was clearly past his peak at that point, but he could still go. And some of those Bucks players are underrated too. They had a guy named John McLaughlin that could stretch the floor, if you want to use a modern term, at shooting guard. They had some athletic power forwards that could kind of do some garbage work. So, no, that would have been the dynasty of the 70s. And I argue in my book that I don't think there really was a dynasty of the 70s. And I think that certainly would have been if they could have kept it together for a couple of years.
Yeah, for sure. And then you know, obviously the dynasty that should have been was the Knicks, and they, sure. You know, they, I guess they got two in the early 70s, but then, you know, got derailed by injuries and whatnot. So that was tough. And you're right, there really wasn't one. I think, you know, the most interesting thing about the merger as we wrap this up is that, you know, the Philly ended up getting Dr. J. And they had a pretty much, you know, like a Miami Heat. Wouldn't you say they were like the Heat of 2010?
Sure, yeah, they had a couple star players, and we focus on Dr. J, but they were a team of superstars. They had George McGinnis, they had Doug Collins. Both Doug Collins had been a number one overall pick. McGinnis was probably the best player in the ABA. Well, he was a top four or five player in the ABA other than Dr. J. And, I mean, having those three on the same team, just they were a mega team, let alone the cast of characters that they had you know, on the bench and everything. But, oh, they were – They had a big three for sure in you know, 76, 77.
Yeah, and I, what I loved about the fact is that they ended up getting beaten by the Blazers, led by, you know, Bill Walton, and then sort of a bunch of role players in a way. And the style of play was really striking. We've done a video on that on one of those games where you can just see how the Blazers kind of ran what you described like in Chicago with a lot of cutting, a lot of movement, and the Sixers in their all-star mode sort of kind of isolated a lot and didn't have as much movement, and they lost. And I thought that was a really fascinating, you know, moment of time where we got one of our last, you know, for a while, sort of these, like, you know, team of not huge stars, not big names, overcoming a star-laden team. That was exciting.
It was, and at the time it was definitely seen as an upset. The Sixers were clearly favored because they had that big three. It's kind of akin to the 2011 when Dallas beat Miami, and it's that Dirk surrounded by a bunch of quality role players in a very similar way of with Walton in 77.
For sure. Well, awesome stuff. I can't recommend enough for people to go out and buy the book. It's called Tall Tales and Short Shorts. Dr. J, Pistol Pete, and the birth of the modern NBA. And there's no question, it certainly, that is the time. That's ground zero, 1970, pretty much, is when, as we talked about, dribbling kind of exploded. Pace was at its highest of all time, and just a really exciting game. And then the ABA merger. So really great stuff, Adam. I can't thank you enough for coming on and discussing this. And, you know, we could do this again sometime.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me, Coach.
You got it. And don't forget, sports fans, at B-Ball Breakdown, we're not a channel, we're a conversation. You in? Are you in, Adam?
Absolutely.